Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Here we are at our new time slot at 11:35 p.m. Feeling great.
That's classic. That's Thank very you. Good. Now, that's a good way to throw some levity in on there, yes.
Yeah, how about that, man?
I have a lot of strong, harsh things to say about that. So, I mean, we've seen this week two instances of studio ignorance. Just blatant studio ignorance, and I guess in the case of maybe conglomerate ignorance is the better word, but I can't get over how NBC wants to destroy the legacy of the Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm.
It's disgusting. It's absolutely
and actually it's ignorance upon ignorance because
yeah.
If the Jay Leno show had been a success, it would have been a gamble that would have paid off, and everybody would look. Like come out of it smelling like roses, but
yeah.
As it turns out, it was an ignoramus move, and now
yeah.
they've added upon that with another ignoramus idea.
Yeah.
And nobody's talking about Jeff Zucker, you know, about his job being on the.
He's supposedly congratulating himself every day, is what I've heard. But it's not just that. This thing with if you remember when it was announced that Leno was going to go to prime time. This pissed off a lot of writers, and rightfully so, because it's like, was it 4 or 5 hours of scripted television went down the tubes, and that caused a huge uproar. And I think Conan here is the one who's getting massively screwed, and he's been such a trooper, and he's done so much. I mean, he filled Dave Letterman's shoes so well, and he really, you know, they're not giving him... you know, his fair share. And the thing I find interesting about Leno is, of course, the numbers are the same. They're late-night numbers is what he has. He does not have prime-time numbers
right.
For that 10:30, that 10 o'clock time slot. So, I mean, yeah, in one instance, you could say, yeah, the audience that watched him at 11:30 followed him, but he didn't bring anything new in, and that's why this thing was started, because the affiliates were complaining that their local news, the lead-ins, were awful.
Yeah. But Conan, love his statement that he made yesterday. I thought that was high
yeah.
class. Very high
it
class.
It was.
And actually, this has the correlation to a movie.
Yes.
Because occasionally these late-night shakeups occur, and the last biggie, the one you're talking about, the Letterman-Leno fight, was made into a movie by Betty Thomas.
That's right.
The Late Shift, was that what it
yeah,
was?
Yeah, The Late Shift, yeah.
Yeah, and a very entertaining movie. What happened mm-hmm. to Betty, what happened to her, Betty Thomas?
Betty Thomas is still making movies, still directing. I don't know what her last thing was, I can look up, but remember, we all know Betty Thomas from Hill Street Blues.
Yeah.
And then she went on a successful directing career, but...
You're looking it up, aren't you?
I am looking it up. Yeah, I have to. I mean, I don't know. I know, but her name has been. Oh, she did. Well, she did Dr. Dolittle. She's. Wait, that can't be right. Oh, you know what she just did? Alvin and the Chipmunks: The Squeakquel.
Oh, so that's how ironic. She has a movie out just the other week.
Yeah, and she might be doing Dallas and. You know, she's a heavy hitter.
She's still doing it. And I hear that she's in line to direct the fourth Spider-Man, too, so that's good.
Now, let's talk about the fourth Spider-Man, because an interesting development has happened. That rumor has it that Mark Webb of 500 Days of Summer is on the fast track to direct this. I don't know how I feel about this.
Well, is it because his last name is Webb?
Well, here's the thing that people are justifying it. And I think that Mark Webb is you know, the salt of the earth. He has made one of the finest directorial debuts, along with several other directors last year who made great debuts. And I have nothing against him at all. I think he's like the rebound for Sony. They broke up with Raimi, and now they're going to Webb. Whoever this director is, whether it's Webb, I feel sorry for whoever the director is going to be, because they're not going to have the freedom that they're used to.
Right.
They're really not. I am very scared that what Sony's trying to do is they're twilighting this.
Well, they're twilighting the Spider-Man franchise, yeah.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
We have to, and there's another movie you have to look at. You have to look at the third Twilight movie that's coming out this summer, because David Slade, who everyone knows from Hard Candy and 30 Days a Night, very artistic director, indie. I don't know what he can bring to that. So that is another case of an independent voice who might get castrated, if you will. I don't know if Mark Webb, I understand why they think he can do it, because he's good at handling, very good at, very sensitive about relationships. Let's not forget that Sam Raimi did a good job in all three with the triangle between Peter Parker, the James Franco character, and Mary Jane.
That was the strength of it. It had emotional bite. I also like the ballsiness of the second one.
Yeah.
The second one, right, where he didn't hide it anymore from her.
Right.
It wasn't something that had to be continued on five or like Clark Kent. Oh, I saw you without your glasses. You have to be Superman. And you know, you don't have to hide it. It's there. And that, I thought that was brave. The thing that worries me too, outside of going with a different director with such a distinctive style and a feel for Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
is the idea of a reboot. Now, what do they mean by reboot? Do they mean starting over and not continuing?
Going back to high school. They're going back to high school. Now, I've got to put this into context because, you know, Batman was long overdue for a reboot because it had been dormant for a long time. James Bond, if you remember, wasn't really dormant that long, but the series, to Die Another Day, I think, was the highest grossing one worldwide, but they just decided to reboot it because of the Bourne movies because they felt Bond had gotten stale. The same thing with Star Trek. The last Star Trek movie came out, I think, the same time as Die Another Day, and that was a dud. That was a disaster.
Right.
And so it was the smartest thing was to reboot it. Spider-Man, though, yes, the third one, I mean, if we go on Chris's review, it was the worst thing ever made. But
look, it's the weakest of the three, but...
No, it is the weakest.
It grossed a ton of damn money. I mean, it hasn't lost steam with audiences.
No.
It's not a smart idea to reboot. You haven't died off. There's nothing to reboot.
Yeah, I don't. It makes no sense. But both of these examples, the Tonight Show, and the Spider-Man thing, just go prove what William Goldman said. No one knows anything out there, and it just reinforces that. The Spider-Man thing is just so perplexing. I just don't know. We talked to the screenwriter a couple of years ago, and it sounded like they had something really solid to work with there. So. I don't know. It's
still the same screenwriter. Apparently, they're using his script, James Vanderbilt.
Right. So, I don't know. I don't know what's going on.
Mm.
But we'll find out. This thing is, I think if Mark Webb's the director, I mean, in one sense, more power to him. I'm glad to see him getting some notice, big notice, but I don't know. I hope he can put as much as his voice as he can into something this gargantuan.
I don't know. I mean, from the director of 500 Days of Summer comes Spider-Man 4. First of all, does he hope one day to make a movie without a number on the title? That's
true. But I mean, you just read his. I have the script for 500 Days of Summer here, and if you read his introduction, the introduction by the two screenwriters, it doesn't sound like he doesn't sound like this doesn't sound like something he wants to do.
Mm.
You know. I mean, I would love to see him actually do another. The screenwriters Scott Neustadter and Michael Weber have a lot of projects in the works. I'd love to see him, you know, work with him again, actually, more than anything else.
Yeah. Speaking of another high-profile sequel for a big action tentpole series, Harrison Ford is making the rounds because of Extraordinary Measures.
That's right.
Which comes out later this month. And, of course, mm-hmm. he's always asked the obligatory questions about another indie. Because, God knows, after that last one, we're dying.
That's what I've been camping out, dude. I keep going to my Regal. Are the tickets on sale yet?
Here's what he had to say.
If and when there ever is another Indiana Jones movie, would you like to hop back into a wheelchair or something, or what?
No, I don't think I'll do it in a wheelchair. George is working on an idea. If it comes to a fruitful stage, all of us are very interested in making another.
Okay. You've called it crazy but great.
What?
You've said in a past interview that George's idea is crazy but great.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate a bit on that?
No.
Do you like crazy ideas? Is that what you're kind of looking for at this point from this episode?
Some of the best ideas are crazy ideas, you know. Well wrought, well manipulated.
And you strike me as the type of person that needs... You don't just do movies. You do a movie when you feel like you have something to do in that movie.
Yeah.
What do you need another Indiana Jones movie to do? You know? What's left that you feel that needs to be fulfilled?
You know, I think it'd be interesting to advance the understanding of the character, as we always have had that ambition throughout the series. I think it would be interesting to deepen the relationship between he and his son,
mm-hmm.
and to play on that relationship. There are a lot of... it's full of opportunity. The series is full of opportunity.
And to see him as a married man, that would be pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Really exciting.
Are you kind of, like, curious to see what Indiana Jones would be like with a wife?
Sure. I think it'd be nice grace notes.
In a way, I would think that would be more fun to play than actually going out and doing the whip and chasing after things like you've done a million times.
We'll see what we come up with.
Is you and Karen actually, like, doing the married thing for a change?
Karen's a wonderful actress. I've always enjoyed working with her. I'm hoping that there'll be a part for all of us in the next one.
All right. So, I guess I'm open to another Indiana Jones. It could be, as Spielberg saw the third one, The Last Crusade, as an apology for the second one, even though that's completely unwarranted, in my opinion.
Time it would be warranted.
I see this as warranted. So this is what I got out of this that really made my heart sink. George came up with a crazy but great idea. Here's a crazy idea. Letting George come up with a story after that fourth one. That's what's crazy. My interest was piqued because my understanding was Spielberg had an idea, had a MacGuffin, had a great idea, and that set it off in me that, hey, maybe there's hope for this one.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. I mean, I'm not really – it was, like you said, I wasn't really chomping in a bit for another one, but if George is – the writing duties are taken away from him and he just gets to sit in the chair on the set, on the sidelines, that's fine. You're, hey, Mr. Lucas, there's an action figure that needs your signature on it. Yeah, sure, thanks. All right, good, he's out of here. We can write something.
Now, George Lucas actually has come out with a book.
He was on The Daily Show. I saw him on The Daily Show. I listened to him on Fresh Air. His name is on the book. It's edited by other people, but he's doing the rounds. And he looks, I don't know. I mean, I'm waiting for that announcement to come. And you know what announcement I'm talking about from him.
It's
coming. Episode 7, 8, and 9. That's what I mean. Because I think he must... You know he must go home at night. And how did Cameron beat me? How did Cameron beat me? He did punching himself, probably like this very Fight Club-esque thing. But I think he's got something in the works. Not so much 7, 8, 9, but I think there's been talk over the years, and we talked about this, I think, the other night, of redoing the Star Wars trilogy in 3D.
I think he should make 7, 8, 9 into one movie and call it Why Was 6 Afraid of 7?
There you go. That's perfect.
That's my favorite first grade joke.
I like that joke. I wish that's I wish he would have told him that. Maybe he would never have made the prequels.
that's the only clean joke I know. Yeah, the book is, in case nobody out there knows what we're talking about, it's about Blockbusters or something?
Blockbusters. Not just his, but all the Blockbusters throughout history. And it's really detailed. It gives, like, all the facts and everything on each one, the technical
right.
and, the, you know, everything that you'd want to know about each film is there.
Hmm. Yeah, so that's probably available in bookstores now.
that was a great plug. That was a really enthusiastic one. I've never heard that kind of... Wait, what does it say? What did Jason... Jason said he's read the book.
Yeah, it's a private joke. Okay. But thanks for making it public. The
I'm sorry,
the other,
I didn't mean to do that again. I'm sorry. Got to stop
other
that.
Thing I wanted to talk about real quick is Sandra Bullock, because she is... becoming, in my opinion, a front runner to win Best Actress.
Yeah, I think that's a good case right there, yeah.
For The Blind Side.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this, because we've talked about this, there is, and it's a sensitive issue with The Blind Side.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talk about the potential for racism that you can find in a Precious. I'm not saying that I think it's racist, but a lot of circles are saying that. There's none of that talk with The Blind Side. Maybe because The Blind Side is a feel-good family movie, and it doesn't, that conversation doesn't really fit. But it's fascinated
right.
me that there hasn't been a conversation about it. But apparently, Sandra Bullock is asked about it quite often. And she was asked about it again on Tavis Smiley's show. And I really liked her answer. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to play that answer because the file isn't working.
Okay, what did she say? Because I've heard of what did she say exactly?
She says she's heard it a lot. She said she doesn't.
Some of the most fascinating conversations
there
I
you
have,
go.
As is the case with any brother, you have in the barbershop.
Because mm-hmm.
the brothers hang out in the barbershop
mm-hmm.
and we
mm-hmm.
talk about everything.
Women, it's in the bathroom.
Same thing? Okay,
yeah.
bath. Okay, brothers in the barbershop, women in the
bathroom.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So in the barbershop, when the trailer, I remember being in the barbershop, literally. When these trailers started running.
Mm-hmm.
And all the brothers in the barbershop had their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Some brother hollers out, another movie about white folk, if I can quote Harry Reid, saving Negroes.
Mm-hmm.
Another movie about white folk saving
mm-hmm.
Negroes.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've heard this before.
Yeah, I heard it from, you know who Lunell is? The comedian?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
She said that.
Lunell, she's
she said,
funny.
I thought you were. No,
yeah.
I love her. She doesn't sugarcoat a thing. But thanks for the support.
So respond. I know it's a true story.
Yeah.
And this is not, this
yeah.
is not your... It's not your burden to bear,
yep.
but I raise this because I think it is Hollywood's burden to bear.
Yep.
The response is, it's a true story. Yes, it is a true story.
Mm-hmm.
There are kinds of true stories about black folk
mm-hmm.
that this town would never make.
Yep.
So the answer can't be just, it's a true story.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you think when you hear people say, why they got to keep making movies of white folks saving Negroes?
Yeah, yeah. Good question. I don't know. I don't know. There's so many amazing stories that deserve to be told
yeah.
about women.
Right.
We don't get our stories told either.
Yeah, no.
Look, you know, when we're in the bathroom and we see the trailer to another we go, why is this another story about a male action hero gets to save the day and the
yeah.
women don't?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Again, it's money.
Yeah.
It's what people want to go see, but guess what? People want to go see anything that's well told.
Mm.
I think it's timing in that we needed something good for the soul. Honestly, I didn't look at it as a black-white issue.
Mm.
To me, it was like, can you take someone off the street and trust your love and trust that person within your home and give that much of yourself
mm-hmm.
and it be just about love, about taking care of your community, about your fellow man, about your friends, your family. You know, would people take in their neighbor if their neighbor was in tough times and love them like they were your own? So many people do that, not just black, white. It has nothing, you know, to me, it had nothing to do with color. It had to do with loving your children.
Mm.
And so many people don't take care of their own children.
Yeah.
So this family was blind to what came after them later on in terms of it's a white family going after a black kid saving. You know, it just, as Leanne said, it wasn't white lady going after the black kid. She goes, it was the mom looking at the child who was cold. Walking home that night, and then it never became a question. And as Sean Toohey said, he just became the ATM for Leanne, building the bedroom, you know, making this home, and giving the brother and sister, SJ and Collins, their brother.
Yeah.
You know, not brother, but their brother. You know, and that's what
that was
to
very
me.
Nice, yeah.
Well, to me, it's so many conversations can come from this. I just go, why is it that we question an act of love? We don't question an act of violence. We sort of like, yes, this is understandable. Look at, we're so happy to talk about violence. We're so quick to question love.
Yeah, I thought that was a good point.
Yeah, that is.
And this is, I don't know the line here, because I think it's almost admirable to have a movie that, like The Blind Side, that does treat it as a non-issue,
mm-hmm.
where most any other movie you'd see would treat it as an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a true story, but I'm sure that this family took him in pure of heart, and they were blind to all of that. But
right.
but what about the other people in their lives? I'm sure that they encountered something that seems a little sanitized for that movie.
They did. I thought there was an interesting subplot towards the end in the movie where where the college that he's like wants to go to, and how it almost seems like the whole family was planning this to get him in, you know, because everyone's like, you know, they gave money to the school and everything. There's that interesting subplot, I think, towards the end. I actually found The Blind Side to be, you know, more engrossing than I ever thought it would be. And she said something very interesting. If the story's well told, people will go see it. People want to see. And I think that's the case with The Blind Side. We have seen the story done many times, but this time it just seemed to come together. It just worked.
Well, her reaction made me think, made me look at my reaction and other people's reaction that asked that question
mm-hmm.
about the lack of any kind of cultural culture clash or race or any question
right.
of that in the film, made me question, well, maybe that says something about me and other
yeah.
people that are asking that question.
Yeah, that's
because
a good
note. We expect that movie to be that way.
Right.
You know, to address those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's refreshing that a movie doesn't.
Right. No, I have no problem with that movie. I surprisingly, you know, I think what she said is something we needed, like an inspiring, feel-good movie. And it just works. And a couple of years ago, I might have seen this movie and might have walked out. But for some reason, it just clicked this time. But no, those are all good points. Now, when you talk about the other film, Precious, are you talking about Arbon White's infamous review?
No, I mean this is a widespread.
Okay. Okay. No, I just thought you meant
criticism of Precious.
Yeah. No, because he's not the only Precious. I mean, not just Arma White, but a lot of very noted African-American columnists in the country, you know, not as, how should we say it, didn't take it quite the way Arma White did, but we're worried that this is how white people see us. And that,
yeah,
I thought, was,
yeah.
That
yeah,
was
yeah,
a legitimate
yeah.
concern, I thought, on Courtland Malloy, who wrote the column in the Washington Post back in November. I thought that was a legitimate. I think Arma White, with his hysteria, you know, doesn't do himself any favors in that regard.
Well, even if Arman White made an intelligent point, people are so conditioned to being so antagonistic to him, it wouldn't
yeah.
come through.
Yeah,
but,
that's true. You're right.
But, you know, that is a concern that I've read about with Precious. Obviously, I'm not in a position to say either way, but
right.
I could say I was a little surprised that it got nominated for a lot of NAACP Image Awards, because
mm-hmm.
so much of what we're shown in that is not positive.
Right.
And it might be true to life, and she overcomes in a way at the end,
mm-hmm.
I guess, which is the journey. The journey is
right.
the important thing, and
mm-hmm.
where she comes out at the end. But she's still, you know, she's still... Is she doomed in a way? I mean, I guess you could argue that her soul is freed, but
mm-hmm.
she's still enchained by a death sentence in a way, isn't she?
Yeah, no, yes, she is. It is not, you know, it ain't the feel-good ending that, you know, of The Blind Side, that's for sure. In one way, yes, there is some sort of catharsis, you could say, but it's very limited because it is, I mean, she's, I know this movie's still in limited release or still in release, but she's doomed. I mean, she is like, I hate to say that, but that's just the reality of her story, given the circumstances and what happens to her. But
well,
that's a very good point, because A.O. Scott wrote about both of the films back in November, and, you know, this is not the, we've heard this thing before about, you know, with an actor who we both like, a lot of people like a lot, Morgan Freeman, who is sometimes cast in this role, you know, in the, as the very wise African-American who saves everybody. You know, whether it be in, remember in Bruce Almighty, when that he played the part of God in that and the other sequel, he was in Million Dollar Baby.
Well, I think that's typecasting of a voice and a presence. I mean, with that voice, it's pretty hard to play bad, even though he did it brilliantly in Street Smart. But.
Oh, yeah, I mean, no doubt it.
Yeah.
But I just, it is something that has been every couple of years that makes the rounds. But nowhere like this with Precious has definitely, you know, woken that up for sure. And that was very good to bring that up, Jamie. That was very good.
Thanks.
No, I'm not being facetious. I'm being
serious. I know you're not. Anytime I get a compliment, I start to blush and I can't take it.
Okay.
You
did a wretched job, Jamie. You did a wretched.
The Ghostbusters 3 is in the writing stages. They're polishing the script that they're happy with. Ivan Reitman wants to start it in the next year.
He wants
I
to
guess.
Direct it.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that's the big news, is he's going to direct.
Yes, yeah. I suppose so. And everybody wants back. I mean, Maurice back, even though it's being rumored that he's coming back as a ghost. You know who's back? That's exciting.
Rick Moranis.
Yes, he's put his country music career on hold, and he's. Have you heard any of his albums, Rick Moranis?
I know that he does. I haven't heard them, but I know that's what he's been doing the last couple of years.
It makes you sympathize with people that hate country. yeah, that's terrible. Rick Moranis.
That is a horrible.
He's like one of those great, great 90s actors, 80s and 90s,
mm-hmm.
that has left the building in a way. So it'd be great to see him come back for something.
Yeah, no, I'm all for that. I love when these Second City Television guys come back to work, and I think Ghostbusters 3, because it's been so long, I think it could work. I don't think it's a sure thing, but I think it has a strong possibility.
Well, because the second didn't work at all, I don't think.
Parts of it worked, but no, compared to the first one, no, it's hard to top. Let's be honest, it's hard to top the first one. I don't know. The third one, you know, you can hear like a lot of people yawning or just, you know, how this seems like a really desperate way to cash in. But who I'm really surprised wants back in is Bill Murray. He turned his back on all of us. Remember, supposedly the only way he'd do Ghostbusters is if they let him do The Razor's Edge in the 80s.
And that turned out well.
He's no Tyrone Power.
A Ghostbusters without Bill Murray isn't a Ghostbusters, you know. I could do
well, remember
that.
Who had that part first? Who had that part was John Belushi. It was written for Belushi.
Yeah. There's something special about all the hijinks in that movie and Bill Murray's detached, sarcastic view of it. I mean, that's what makes the movie work. You know, that first Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. People are in the chat room flirting with my girlfriend. I'm not very comfortable.
I'm not flirting with your girlfriend. Jason is flirting with your girlfriend.
Right.
flirting with everyone. I think he's trying to flirt with me probably, too.
Oh, he flirts with me. Speaking of Jason, okay, I'll bring up Jason. I'm going to give him a statement. And then we're going to play this interview. We did, okay, on this Sunday on our show, this coming Sunday, we have the Decade in Film. And it's going to be unique in that we're going to have three different perspectives. Chris is going to review his top 10 favorite movies of the decade. I'm going to review the top 10 cinematic trends of the decade. You're going to review, tell us.
I'm going to do like directors and who I think will have a, who made an impact in this decade, or at least made a splash, who I think will have a greater impact in the next decade.
Right.
Did I blow that?
No, you'll do better on Sunday. So it's going to be a unique show, and I'm really fascinated to hear everyone's choices. On Jason's show the other night, we did our top 10 of the year. I was very proud of mine. Mine was a very colorful list.
What was your list? What was?
I don't have it in front of me, but I can tell you what was on it. Taken. A good trashy action movie that's efficient and lean, and I just enjoy the heck out of it every time I watch it. Taken, The English Surgeon was my favorite documentary of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Invictus was on the list. The Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
What else was on the list? I can't even remember.
Well, kudos to The Hurt Locker, my friend.
Hurt Locker was like number four or something. On my list.
I'm going to say it now. Jeremy Renner is nominated for Best Actor. I want him to win.
State of Play.
That was a good one.
So that's five. It wasn't No Up in the Air, No Avatar. Inglourious Basterds was my number one.
You put it on there?
Yeah, it was my number one movie of the year.
I love you.
thank you.
And that will just destroy the whole show now. I've ruined the show.
Number three was Nine.
Mm-hmm.
Number two was The Lovely Bones.
Wow, that's the only list that's been on.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Good for you.
I agree, Jason. In theory, Up in the Air is my number two as well. Just not on any kind of list, but actually number two. Because that's what I thought of Up in the Air. And I got two that are missing. And I can't remember what they were, but that was the kind of list I compiled.
That was a good list. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and I just don't understand why people are – I understand the criticisms against Nine. I like it regardless. I can't understand why Lovely Bones is not reaching people. I don't get it. I have a feeling, though, the people, when they see it, it will reach them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll reach a large percentage of the people that actually go and see it and aren't too critical minded, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think people are being it's just from the reviews I've read, way too harsh on it. Just what I've seen. You know, forget what I even see. I've seen the reviews. Just what I see on Twitter.
Right.
Alone and on Facebook status updates. You know, it's just. It can't be that bad. That's all I got to say.
Well, it's weird for me, and I've said this, that so many movies, or a few movies that have been reviled this year, I've ended up loving, and vice versa, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm usually not somebody that tries to just disagree for the hell of it.
Right. No, we only know one person like that.
Right. It's really moved me. There's one more story because you brought up Armand White, and then we'll get into the interview. This is an interesting story. Armand White is the head of the New York Film Critics Association. And they have their annual awards banquet, and it's a big deal. A lot of people show up, and they accept their award. A lot of big people present the awards. Armand White was putting together presenters and things, and he sent out a request to Keith Olbermann, or somebody sent out a request to Keith Olbermann to present a filmmaker an award. I forget which filmmaker it was. And he was very excited, Keith Olbermann, because he loved this film. So he said, okay, I can't make it there by 8:30. I can make it there by 9:15 if I pre-tape a segment on my new show that night, and then I can race over and I can present this award because I really want to do it.
Right.
So,
okay.
So they had him booked, and Armand White said, "No, we're going to start on time." It was screenplay. It was for the In the Loop screenplay. He said, "We're going to start on time, and screenplay isn't important enough to push to the end of the show. So we're going to have it at the beginning. Tell Keith not to bother." And so Keith Olbermann went through all this trouble, and then he was told, "No, don't worry about it. We don't need you." And so he was ticked, and he was saying, "Well, I hope Armand White and the New York Film Critics like bad publicity, because that's what I'm going to give to them." Meanwhile, the show was supposed to start at 7:30, and it started like an hour late. So Keith Olbermann would have been perfect when he would have come on. But that's like a thing brewing, and even these critic awards shows have big drama.
Yeah.
Especially if Armand White is the head of your...
Well, he brings it with him. He just brings it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's always interesting to me, too, that how people give the awards out in the New York Film Critics Circle, probably to movies that Armand hated every last one of them. And he's the head of the organization.
You know, if you want to really have a big show, a really awesome show, we got to have Glenn Kenny and Armand White on at the same time.
I've always said that. That would be the best.
That would be incredible.
I don't like conflict, so I wouldn't say a word. I would put us all on mute, and I would let them go at it.
Aaron could moderate it.
No, I don't want that.
I'm just joking.
The Book of Eli, Jerry.
Yes?
Opens this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first movie from the Hughes brothers in a while. I know they did, since From Hell, feature film-wise, but they did a segment on New York, I Love You. Was that the name of it, New York, I Love You?
I think they did.
Yeah, they did a segment on that, which was one of those multi-director, multi-short films kind of compilations. And our guest tonight, Atticus Ross, worked with them on that, and has worked with them on several projects. But The Book of Eli actually marks his feature film composing debut, and his score is stunning. And we're going to close the show tonight with a 7-minute track of his score. You guys will be able to hear it. It's an incredible sounding score. Atticus actually, he kind of fell into film composition through the Hughes brothers. It wasn't something he necessarily considered in his music career thus far. He's been busy producing and performing and programming and engineering people like Pink and most notably Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails. And he's formed a band called Error, and he works with a band called 12 Rounds. So that's the realm of music that he comes from. But I think he's a real fresh, exciting new voice in film composition. So I'm pleased to bring this interview to you. This is Atticus Ross talking about working with the Hughes brothers and the musical soundscape he composed for The Book of Eli. I'm a huge fan of film scores in general. Did you come from an appreciation of film scoring yourself?
Well, I've certainly always loved instrumental music. And, you know, and I've loved scores kind of, you know, in the cinema. But it wasn't like I had a huge collection of scores. I had some, and then I certainly bought a lot more after I got the job to try and figure out how it was done. But it's more, I think, just, you know, the idea of instrumental music and some of my favorite bands, Mogwai, for instance, you know, is a very cinematic band, which are 90% instrumental.
Right. Even so, you're working, when you compose a film, you're working in the service of the directors, which I suppose is probably about the same as maybe when you produce a band, you're working in the service of their desires or their sound, what they want. What was the biggest learning curve when you took on film composition for you?
I mean, there's some similarities, but I do think it's a very, very different beast. You know, I think what's similar is the idea of the communication aspect, you know, sitting with creative people. You know, with a band, it's different because they're musicians, obviously. In the Hughes Brothers case, they're very music-driven, and they're very musically aware. And, you know, the one, they're both very involved musically, but the one who kind of, you know, they kind of divide up the workload on a movie, and Alan's more the overseer of the music. And he has an absolutely huge knowledge of music, and a huge knowledge of film music as well, and the role that music plays in film. I think what's unusual about them, you know, speaking to friends of mine who actually do films more often, is that there's a part of the process at the beginning where you get together with them, you know, and I've done a few different things with them now, and it's always been the same. With the Book of Eli, it was actually, they were more developed, if you like, you know, but what I'm talking about is prior to cameras rolling, you know, there's a lot of conversation, and in this case, they've done this really excellent lookbook thing, you know, like those iBooks you can get made off iPhoto or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And within it was pictures, you know, very kind of clear view of what the movie was going to look like, and these kind of a series of quotes from all over the place, you know, that were kind of these evocative quotes. And then I sort of sat down with Alan, and we went through that, and we went through various, you know, films that he liked or books or anything really that kind of captures, you know, records or whatever, the kind of area that he's aiming for. And in this case, I think we wrote 12 pieces before they went off to shoot, because they like the actors to have some music, you know, and kind of, you know, they give everybody CDs and blah, 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 that kind of, you know, just to try and capture the atmosphere of what's going. And the main, the track that starts the score album, which is kind of the main theme, Panoramic, that was done before the picture was shot. And actually, at the end of the film, the pitch is cut to the music rather than the other way around, if you know what I mean.
Wow. That is unique. and so it doesn't, if that was written in the pre-production phase, that main title, then as it turns out, what we hear in the finished film, you know, thematically, it didn't change a whole lot.
No, I mean, you know, that was the exception piece in terms of, you know, that was like, this is, when they heard that, they were like, this is the sort of perfect, this is the world that we're going for, you know, atmospherically. And obviously we go miles away from that with the orchestra or whatever, but
sure. In
terms of the actual instruments, but in terms of the mood, you know, it's all, you know, I know that some are, you know, kind of more intense, this and that, but there's a certain world that I think it all lives in. And I think that the, you know, the reason to my ear that it holds together as a score is to do with the mood. You know, it allows us to go from, you know, these very, you know, there's a couple which are very synthetic sounding or noisy, you know, Solara Violated or whatever, which is a part of a 3-series piece, you know, to purpose, which is, you know, just the orchestra playing, you know, on their own. There's no, you know, it's the main string piece. And I think it's, you know, it's that mood that allows it not to sound like, you know, a bunch of disparate elements that are just kind of stuck together.
So when you look at the photos, or when you talk to them about the themes and the setting and the feel of the film, how do these ideas, musical ideas, start to come together? What themes do you latch on to, and what what instruments and sounds do they produce for you?
Well, the first set of writing, like the first 12 pieces that we delivered, which I think there's probably aspects of three of them in the film. You know, there's one thing where there's an advantage because I think that me and Alan have a similar aesthetic. And I kind of know from the time that I've spent with him and the various things that we've done together that there's a kind of area that he's going to respond to, and then there's a, you know, there's stuff that he probably wouldn't, you know. And it's similar, the kind of thing that I like and the kind of thing that he likes. And in this particular film, you know, they wanted a very textured, layered, kind of, you know, evocative, you know, and there is this thing, you know, because it was quite tricky in a way that it isn't an action film. It isn't, you know, only. It isn't like
right.
a dark film only. And it's not a kind of feel-good film only, you know, but it lives in this kind of weird area. And there's a big part of the film is about this kind of spiritual,
mm-hmm.
spiritually evocative, you know what I mean? And
mm-hmm.
trying to kind of get something and get the music that can, you know, thread through all those different things, you know? I mean, there is a darkness. You know, and that's really summed up by Gary Oldman.
Right.
And the pieces that accompany him, this was something, you know, like you write some up front, and then as the picture starts coming in, you know, and the film starts to develop and the edit happens, you know, you switch from that broader thing into zeroing in on, like you said at the beginning, how best to serve this picture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are ultimately a cog in the machine, you know, and I think with the Hughes brothers, they allow that to be quite a big cog. But it's the kind of low horn pieces that you know, accompany Gary more.
Right. The soundscape that you've created for this movie is so unique and distinctive. And when you know where you can kind of characterize the film, I know characterizations are generally not fair and not quite accurate, but you know that you're dealing with a apocalyptic setting, religious themes. Are there sounds that you're trying to avoid? Was there a conversation about what they didn't want from the music?
Well, there was a couple of different things. I mean, one, that the acting, you know, you've got Denzel Washington and you've got Gary Oldman as the two kind of leads. So you've got this, you know, really high standard
mm-hmm.
of acting, which allowed the music to be freer, because it wasn't like, you know, sometimes you see a film and it's like there's a scene and it's a sad scene and now there's some sad music playing because I guess it's like, you know, we're all meant to feel sad at this point. You know what I mean? It's like the
mm-hmm.
music's got to inform the scene. And that's not to say the music in this, you know, isn't carefully considered scene by scene, but if Gary's angry, you don't need a lot of angry music underneath him. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
And you can do it, and you can add to that, but maybe not in, you know, such a kind of traditional way. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the actual, you know, I knew what I wanted to avoid. Just that thing of where, you know, I think in the Book of Eli, the fact, you know, that it's post-apocalypse is just a setting, you know what I mean? It's not, in some films, it's, you know, of that nature, that's the kind of essence of the film.
Right.
But in this, I think the essence of the film is this journey, you know, this kind of physical journey that he takes, you know, the spiritual journey that he takes, and the sort of metaphorical journey that he takes. You know, the one thing that I knew, you know, there's been like a recent bunch of apocalypse films, and it seems like, you know, the apocalypse is going to sound like a really bad industrial band from 1992.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to avoid, you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, when you talk about the kind of soundscape aspect of that, I think, you know, we put a lot of time into trying, you know, who knows what it's going to sound like then. So it should feel unusual, you know what I mean? It
mm-hmm.
should evoke a kind of new place, if you know what I mean. You know, so even, you know, I think that, you know, quite a bit of the score is actually quite traditional, even though, you know, people have mentioned it being unusual. But certainly the orchestral side of things. But for me, it was always about the backdrop that you place that in. You know, it sounds unusual because of the setting that it's in. It's not like, you know, the orchestra has been made to sound weird. You know
right.
what I'm saying? Like,
right.
You know, after we went to do that, it was so incredible. You know, I mean, particularly for, you know, the whole Abbey Road experience was so great. I didn't touch any of the stuff that we did there. I wanted it to sound very organic and very like those, you know, brilliant players in that room. You know, the kind of strangeness of it at times, I think, is just to do with the backdrop that it's set against, you know. And that, more than anything, is the kind of that world of the future.
I was actually going to ask you about working in Abbey Road, because I would think for a musician that studio has to be hallowed ground in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually worked there before. You know, obviously I'm from England,
mm-hmm.
but I'd never worked with an orchestra anyway. I'd done string sessions here and there, but never anything, you know, anything even approaching that. And everyone we had involved, you know, because there is an aspect, like, I've certainly done things in the past where you're really excited and you're going off somewhere special and, you know, it's meant to be this great thing and, you know, it turns into something that sucks. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's an aspect of, you know, I was happy with the music and I think is it going to be a disappointment or whatever. And it really was, you know, one of the best musical experiences I've ever had, you know, in terms of the quality, you know, just the whole operation there, you know, incredible conductor, you know, really A-class players. The engineer was this guy called Jeff Forster, who, you know, I think, I didn't know him before, but I think if you were a film person, you'd know him because he's, you know, he's always recording for Hans Zimmer or whatever, and just the smoothness and the kind of way it was done. And, you know, they're really, you know, it's like incredible first take kind of stuff, you know, brilliant orchestration by Dana New. I mean, it really, you know, I know I sound like I'm effervescing, but it really was good.
This interests me too. Going back to the unique working relationship you have with the Hughes brothers, you saying that the film kind of is cut around the music instead of vice versa to a large extent.
Well, not only in that one bit at the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me about the, I guess you'd call it the spotting sessions, deciding where the music should go, because what fascinates me is a big part of what you do, a big tricky part, is deciding where music should not go,
right.
just as much as where it should go.
Well, they had some ideas from the off that I think worked really well, which was, you know, in the kind of action bits, generally the kind of action is the music, you know, the sound of the guns, the kind of explosions or whatever, you know, like we didn't ramp it up under there. There's bits and pieces. But, you know, the whole spotting aspect of it is something that's, you know, changing and developing as time goes, you know what I mean, and as the edit goes. You know, in the original, what happened at the start was, you know, like I said, we'd done some music up front, and then we broke, and they went off to shoot, and I was off doing something else. And then I came back, and I'd get emails, because Albert does a lot of, like, you know, the kind of technical editing, and, of course, Cindy, who's the, you know, the main editor in the thing. And Albert would say, hey, could you get me some, I need some X or Y, you know what I mean, like atmospheric stuff, or I need a piece that has some rhythm that I can cut to and it's going to be with, you know, but I hadn't really seen the picture at that stage. And then Cindy has a, you know, a kind of library of, you know, these early pieces. And they kind of get a feel for where the music should be, you know, and some of the stuff, there might be the perfect piece, or there might be a piece that, you know, is kind of in the right area, but that'll be a piece that, oh, I see what they're trying to do, and then I'll rewrite to the picture or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, and as time went on, different things would come up, you know, because Denzel's character, in a sense, was easier to write for because he spends a lot of time kind of, you know, he's a man of few words. So
right.
he's walking, and I knew very much about his character, you know what I mean, and what we were trying to evoke with him. The one that was harder was Gary, because he's talking all the time, you know, and he's saying great stuff, so you don't ever want to get in the way of him, but at the same time, he needed something to, there needed to be a musical contrast between the two. And it was Alan that came up with this idea of the horns, you know, which, you know, you don't hear that much anymore, or maybe I've zoned out to you, but I, you know, love the sound of horns. And, you know, and that was one of the kind of, you know, really challenging and fun bits of doing it.
When you're watching the movie, I know that you've watched it, probably seen it many, many times in the process of scoring it, but when you watch it to the screening, or, you know, the last time you watched it, as a composer and as someone that's so intricately involved in the actual process of putting it together, are you able to remove yourself from that process and enjoy the film?
It's funny because, you know, they had the premiere the other night, which I went to, you know, and you know, I did the score with my wife and my brother. He's away, but me and my wife went, and it was the first time that I was able to, like, sit back and just enjoy the film, you know, without zoning in on, oh God, that sounds terrible, you know, whatever.
Right.
And also, it was the first time I'd ever seen it with finished picture, because all the time you work on the dub stage, for some unknown reason, apparently it's some kind of film tradition that you always have kind of not very good looking picture there. And particularly in this film, where the look of it, that's a character, you know, that's one of the movie characters, if you like. So to sort of see it, and also to see it with a bunch of people who, you know, to be in a big room with people who hadn't seen it a lot. And the other thing that was exciting about that, you know, whenever it was a couple of nights ago, was I score the movie as best I see it, or we score the movie. But when it goes to the dub stage, Alan Hughes does another layer, if you like, of musical production. And often, you know, I might deliver a cue in the way that I see it, and then he might change it in there in terms of, you know, he has a set of 12 stems or whatever it is that make up the cue. He might choose, oh, let's take that one out and drop the drums there, and, you know, ramp it up here, or whatever it is. And he's really excellent at that, I've got to say. And there were certain bits that happened right at the very end, you know, the last couple of days, or even on that very last day, and I wasn't there. So it was kind of like, wow, I've never seen that before, and it actually sounds really good. You know, and I did watch it, and kind of, when I was heading in there, obviously I was nervous, and I thought everyone's going to see through, and it's going to sound so, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but unprofessional or something. But actually, you know, I watched it and I didn't feel embarrassed, and you know, I thought it came across really good. And we had then another guy, Chris Jenkins, who was the guy who mixed it, and he's like an Oscar-winning guy. You know what I mean? I think he's head of sound at Universal or whatever. And for some reason, he took a real interest in the score. And, you know, from early on, like, he saw a rough edit very early on and sort of went out of his way, I think. You know, he'd come down the studio, he'd open up the soundstage to us, you know, and just go way beyond what would be the normal call of duty, you know, to make it something special, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and that was another real, you know, really, really important part of getting it right with the picture.
Is this something that that you want to definitely do more of? And if so, is there a dream genre that you'd love to compose for?
You know, I don't think I'd be good at romantic comedy.
Right. Those probably are the hardest to compose, too.
Probably. But I would love to do another film. You know, I really had a great, you know, I really enjoyed the whole process of this one. Was fantastic. And I think part of it was that made it so good was having all these people, you know, like everyone on this project was very focused on what it was going to be, and whether it's a big box office success or not, it would still be a great success to me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I feel really proud of music, and I think the film is really good. And like I say, the experience, you know, I couldn't have asked for anything better than that. And I think that more than anything, that's built on the people that are involved. You know, and this went right across, you know, to the producers on this, and I'm not just saying this because, you know, you're meant to, but it was like, they had a sort of confidence in it where there wasn't that kind of micromanaging aspect.
Right.
You know, I only got one note from the producers, which was, hey, we really like the music, keep going, you know.
Mm.
And much as this is good, I could see how a different situation could not be good. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I actually got called in, and it will go unnamed, over Christmas to possibly do a couple of scenes in a film that, you know, was a big film, but it lots of chaos around it, and I didn't do it. And it, you know, I would love to do another film. I would really like it to step into some kind of similar world in terms of, you know, a clear picture of what the film was, you know, and hopefully I think having done one now, and also I think, you know, I learned an incredible amount. I'm sure, you know, there are things even through this process that I might approach differently, you know, given the same set of circumstances again, in terms of musically. But I think it kind of gives enough of a picture of what I might be able to bring to the project, and hopefully it would be a project, you know, who would want that specifically that might come to me. And at the same time, if I don't get to do another one, that's okay too. You know what I mean? Like, this was great.
Yeah, it sounds like an ideal experience. Like you've really been kind of spoiled by the experience of doing this. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm really lucky in the sense that, you know, I have a career doing records, so
mm-hmm.
it's not like I have to do whatever next comes along. I mean,
right.
that work runs out as well. You know, it's touch wood. But, you know, I think it's, you know, in all things in life, particularly in kind of the artistic side, it's you serve yourself well by kind of, you know, waiting for the right thing and making the choices based more off that, you know, than, you know, the artistic side of things, you know, because to be able to, you know, you say you enjoy the score and stuff, you know, to deliver something that you can enjoy, you need all those other things in place.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? You know, one needs to have that, an aspect of that, you know, musical freedom and the belief from the directors and the producers involved, you know, that you can do it. You know what
yeah.
I'm saying?
Well, I personally hope you do more scoring because I'm a great lover of film scores, and this is one of my favorites I've heard in a long time that you've done for Book of Eli. So,
I appreciate that.
I appreciate you coming on and talking to me. I've really enjoyed it, and let's do it again sometime.
Okay, great. Well, let's hope I can do another one, and then we can.
Okay, Atticus Ross, the score is The Book of Eli, and the score itself is available in stores now, and the movie opens Friday, January 15th.
It sounds very, it's fascinating. I didn't realize that was his background, so I found that very fascinating.
Yeah, and you'll be able to hear some of the score at the end of the show tonight, and it's a great one. It's a great one. Avatar.
It's still in the news. No, because the Vatican reviewed it. I didn't know they had movie critics at the Vatican, so, I mean, this is news to me.
Right, and they said that it had no religious or it had no value, essentially?
Something along those lines. It was a very mixed to negative review from the Vatican.
What do they think of Men Who Stare at Goats? What do they think of a single man? I'd like to know that.
Oh, you really want to go on the fall off the tightrope?
I tell you what, they probably love Lovely Bones.
They might. That's a very good point. That's a great point.
If only it was a boy. Now, Avatar continues to rise, and it's at $441 million in the U.S. It's making about $5 million a weekday at this point.
Yeah.
So, Dark Knight is entirely doable. Number two mm-hmm. in the U.S. all time is entirely doable. I was talking to my dad tonight. He said, you know who you should get? That director. And I was like, what? Because he's not like a movie guy. So it's always endearing when he tries to talk to me about the show. He always shows an interest. And he said, you know, the guy that has the top two movies of all time.
Hey, we tried. We did try.
Yeah, and I said, you know what, Dad? For as technologically advanced as all of his movies are, they're on the cutting edge. He only accepts interview requests by fax, which I find fascinating. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Did I tell you that?
No.
Yeah, but he's incredible. I think I'm getting a call. I think Aaron's on the line calling me.
Speaking of sexy voices.
Yeah. So what else is going on? Is there anything? The Book of Eli, what else opens up this weekend?
Oh, well, The Lovely Bones goes wide. And then there's another movie that opens, another movie that maybe I would have been excited about like 25 years ago. And that's a Jackie Chan movie. Which just looks god awful. I used to really like Jackie Chan a lot, but some of these movies he's made, and this is obviously he's trying to cash in on what Vin Diesel, I guess, did with The Pacifier a couple of years ago, and this just looks unbearable.
The movie is called The Spy Next Door, and it's really made for those people that couldn't wait to see Jackie Chan share the screen with Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yes, okay, it's Billy Ray. I was wondering who that was. All right, yes. All right.
Variety reviewed it.
And what did they say?
I think their point was, actually, it was in the first paragraph. It said, the first sentence, it said, we never thought Jackie Chan would stoop this low.
Well, right there.
Yeah, and then the following week, we have the new Harrison Ford movie, Extraordinary Measures, which is the first movie produced by CBS Films. And I hope it escapes the syndrome of being a TV movie of the week at the theater.
I hope so, too. It could be, it's another case where you have all this A-list talent and still just a, you know, like you said, a movie, TV movie of the week, like My Sister's Keeper or something, so.
Yeah. And then you have Legion, which is a horror film with Paul Bettany and Dennis Quaid.
Dennis Quaid has been very busy lately.
Yeah. Yeah, I just got a movie of his in the mail, what is the sci-fi movie you did with Ben Foster,
Pandorum, you got that in the mail.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. And then we have the Tooth Fairy from The Rock.
That's just talk about stupid low.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That just looks really bad. I'm sorry. I know it's for little kids, but I still think it looks bad.
And so I really don't think anything the next 2 weeks will replace Avatar at the top. Probably not until Edge of Darkness comes out on the 29th.
Yeah, I think Edge of Darkness is the first movie now that could do it. I was thinking Book of Eli, but I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so is there anything else you want to go over before
we
close?
We talked about the most important entertainment that Conan O'Brien, Spider-Man 4, The Precious and The Blind Side, and the Armand White thing with Overman, and I think we really got it all covered.
All right, so we're going to close the show with a selection from the soundtrack to The Book of Eli, Mr. Atticus Ross, and we will be back on Sunday with a great show. These are always popular
awesome
shows.
Show.
When we do a list, they're always popular. And then, for those that were expecting a Sundance show tonight, it will air next Wednesday because we're working on some pending interview requests and we want to get every filmmaker we can in that show. So that'll be next Wednesday, I think 2 days before the festival actually begins. Or, no, 1 day before. It opens on the 21st, Sunday.
Wait, I have a question for you. It's a TV scheduling question. Are the Golden Globes on the same time as the 24 premiere?
Well, they are.
Damn it. Okay, this is going to be...
The Golden Globes start at 8 Eastern.
Okay.
24 starts at 9 Eastern. Big Love starts at 9 Eastern. So my TiVo is going to be on overdrive on Sunday.
Yeah, I hear you, man. It's going to be...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's going to be a nightmare. Okay.
Okay, so we'll close off the show, and we'll see you back here Sunday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, good night, everyone.
Bye, guys.
You.